listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Of our three poets tonight, our three wonderful poets, one of our wonderful poets, Chris Abani, unfortunately has food poisoning. We don't know what it is yet. So we have the great pleasure and the great good fortune that Kate Gale, who is the editor and founder of Red Hen Press, is going to read some of her work as our third poet. And we're going to begin with Kate, whom I will introduce. And then she will introduce our other poets, Doug Kearney and Peggy Schumacher. So, to begin with, Kate Gale, who is the managing editor of Red Hen Press, and she is a full-time literary provocateur, and I really mean it. Kate is everywhere around town. She is a great force in the community, bringing different organizations together, promoting poetry. She has an amazing blog. She's one great force in the literary world. She is an editor, writer, literary citizen, and arts manager. She's been a visiting poet at Pomona College and has taught in the Graduate Humanities Program at Mount St. Mary's. She teaches publishing courses at Antioch, Los Angeles. She does a lot of speaking at writers' conferences and residency MFA programs. And in 1994, she founded Red Hen Press, which has an astonishing track record of publishing very, very interesting and influential writers. You'll want to check out their website. And it's become one of the largest independent presses in Southern California. So our format tonight will be Kate will read, and then she will introduce our other two readers. Afterwards, there's a book signing in our lobby. Books are on sale tonight, courtesy of our library store, and purchasing a book here does help support the Los Angeles Public Library, and we thank you for that as well. We also have a donation jar, and we also really appreciate your support in keeping these free programs going. Without further ado, it is a great honor to introduce Kate Gale. Please welcome her.
Well, I am very surprised and pleased to be reading here tonight. When I got the call from Louise, I was 3 miles from here, and I pulled off the freeway to see if I had any of my books in the car, but I had just cleaned out my car, and so I didn't, but this is one of those venues that has all the electronics, and so I was able to quickly print some poems. So these are poems from my new book that I'm sending around, and the book is called The Goldilocks Zone. And the Goldilocks Zone is that area of space where we could comfortably live. So that's where they're always looking for possible life. So I'm going to start with a poem that's called Fields. As a child, I read the Bible a lot. And so I grew up in one of those places where they were always reading you the Bible and having you read the Bible. And so there were a lot of Bible stories I was fascinated with, and one of them was the story of the children of Israel wandering for 40 years. And I could look at the map and see that that distance was quite short. It's roughly the distance from Los Angeles to San Diego. So this poem is called Fields. The children of Abraham left Egypt, crossed the Sinai Peninsula, entered Canaan after 40 years, a distance less than the stretch of miles from San Diego to Los Angeles, crossed on foot by the Jimenez family in 10 days. Papa Jimenez carried Clara on his shoulders. They sought farm work. The Israelites expected to work in the fields, were guided by a pillar of cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night. The Jimenez family found guidance from a AAA map purchased at a Unocal station near the border, a blue flashlight. They ate corn tortillas, missed pupusas and sopa. The Israelites ate manna and quail, longed for garlic and onions. The Hebrews died in Sinai, their children entered Canaan. The Jimenez parents died in trailers by the Ventura fields. Their children went to community college, opened a bakery. The children of Israel wander between San Diego and Los Angeles. They approach Gelson's, the strawberries fresh, the meat kosher. The Jimenez family attend Mass, eat blessed bread, drink wine. I was at the gym one day and a few years ago, and on Fox News, which is sort of an oxymoron, there was a little heading that said, "Illegal aliens are bringing in syphilis and gonorrhea." And then I went home and was kind of looking this up, and then I found another little interesting quote from Pat Buchanan, which said, "The Mexican government has a program to push its poor, unemployed, and uneducated into the United States." I liked that. A program. It's like a little mission they've got. Americans love the rugged individualist, the cowboy, riding off into the desert, leaving behind town and woman, swinging into the saddle to discover more battles, more Indians. John Wayne, exposed to nuclear fallout, died of stomach cancer. Humans like to move, migrate for food, water, jobs, city life, country life, small town life, be near oceans, lakes, trees, meadows, live where it's warm, live near the Arctic Circle, find themselves, lose themselves, find somebody else, get away, create new family, be a loner. John Wayne, somebody's idea of what a man should be, large, silent. A man who stands in the doorway, watches you cook, eats the food, doesn't speak. The room is full of him. If you're married to John Wayne, that's enough, it's all going on. The 70s, women got to choose between Prissy Paris and Manly Hector. American men didn't want to fight in Vietnam, wanted to lie on the grass of endless college towns smoking dope next to girls who didn't cook. STDs were on the rise, women were singing. The 80s, men were making money. Mexicans were moving to the U.S., the coming of the night. According to Jerry Falwell, AIDS is not just God's punishment of homosexuals, it is God's punishment for a society that tolerates homosexuals. We are not John Wayne. We are in a room full of people. We cannot leave the room. It is all we have. We cannot shove the people out of the room who do not look like us. When a spider becomes too greedy, the web collapses on its own weight. The alpha male discovered America. The alpha male rode in countless spaghetti westerns. The alpha male bloodied his nose in Vietnam. The alpha male was carrying the flag by the river one night. The river boiled over. The rest of the story has not been told. We know the story will be told to music, but what happens after Let There Be Light? When I was a kid, as I said, we had to read the Bible a lot, and we memorized a lot of verses, and this was one of the ones that we memorized that I still sort of think about. And it's from Corinthians. "Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing." So the idea is you're just supposed to be good to people. So this poem is called Christian Hookers. "Teetering next to the Texas long neck beer is a bowl of chips that old man Fish is sharing with his buddy Zone. Fish and Zone have been out of work 8 months. Crawling back and forth between the skin of potatoes and bags of old rice. But tonight, Fish got some money from his aunt, and he's sharing it with Zone. Got a surprise for you, Fish, Zone says. Couple of hookers waiting for us at the motel. That so? Fish says. No, but it's the thought that counts. Got the condoms, though. Just in case hookers drop out of the sky. That would be mighty Christian of him, Fish says. Mighty Christian, Stone agrees. So on that subject, one of the things that you just can't drop when you grow up as a Christian, even if you drop the whole Christian thing, is the whole idea of praying. Because you sort of grow up and you're praying and everything, so even when you don't really believe in the whole thing, you find yourself continuing to pray. And the thing is with praying is most of your prayers are not answered. They're just kind of ignored, but you keep on doing it anyway. So it doesn't work, but you keep doing it. So this is some of the prayers that I've tried in my life that didn't work, but I continued with. And this is called To Sleep. And this is from the Bible verse, pray without ceasing. Good Lord, do not let the condom break. Let the baby be healthy. Let this labor be short. Let me sleep. Make the kid better. Let me sleep. Make the kid be quiet. Let me sleep. Make the kid talk to me. Let me sleep. Make the kid be quiet. Let me sleep. Make the kid's friends be quiet. Let me sleep. And now to sleep, perchance to dream. There's a story in the Bible about 10 virgins that wait with their lamps for their bridegroom. And I always thought that this had to really suck because actually only 5 of them get to be with the bridegroom. But what's this whole idea of these 10 girls waiting around for this guy till midnight anyway? It really, really ticked me off as a kid. So here we go. Gender differences according to the Bible. And the verse is, then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. 5 were wise, 5 were foolish. Some ran out of lubricant. No, I mean oil. Didn't get to be one of the main virgins. Only 5 had enough. Lucky bridegroom lines up his virgin, sets off fireworks in the bedroom. Heaven for men. Women waiting eagerly with lamps for him to appear. In women's heaven, a long line of James Bonds wait until midnight for our arrival, not a virgin among them. Each of them, highly skilled lovers, masseuses, chefs, dancers, kissers, bartenders, comedians, and of course their acrobats. Fundamental difference between the sexes. It's all right there in the Bible. We require skill. Men are fine with a layabout. When we say kiss me, by God, you better know how. I thought you ladies would like that. Okay, I have 3 poems left here. This one is the last sort of based on a Bible verse one. I know you're thinking, get over it, Kate. So this place that I grew up was sort of a boarding school for unwanted kids. And so they're big on sort of beating kids and so on to try to sort of beat the badness out of you. So it again starts with a Bible verse from Psalms, and the poem is called Leaping Like Antelope. And the verse is, who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully. So again, sort of the idea of this was the people that get to be sort of in the room with God are people that are holy, which unfortunately was not yours truly often as a kid. Let me see you. Hands up, palms out. Look me in the face, head up. Eyes here, stand up straight, stand up, look here. You are filthy, your hands are filthy. You have sand in your hair, charcoal on your face. Do you swim in filth? Do you walk with the devil? Look me in the eyes, I'm talking to you, that's it. Shifty eyes show me you have something to hide. Let me see your hands. Yes, ma'am, I say. Out come my hands full of toads. The toads are hopping and loose. The counselor is screaming. There will be beating. Angels, listen, bear me witness. I repeat verses as I fall asleep. Who shall ascend? Perhaps not I, Lord, I say. I may be counting toads. The bridge from me to holiness is too treacherous for one so young as I. But I shall collect thy toads, so thy counselors shall leap forthwith onto thy chairs. Okay, so these last two are about starting Red Hen Press. My husband and I started this. We're in our 16th year, and it's a lot of work, and it's crazy, and. It's sort of about that whole process of what you're willing to live without and the craziness of it, and there we go. the house that Jack built. We built a house of glass in the woods. The rain came in. The rain came in through the skylight, the open windows. We sealed the house, yet water seeped under the foundation. We built canoes to navigate the stream from kitchen to bedroom. All the bookshelves were up high. The cement floor wore away to gravel. We lived in a stream bed in a glass house until the day the sun came out. It became hot, humid. Orchids filled the air, their tendrils of longing everywhere. Visitors said our house was unnatural, but it seemed perfectly natural to us. The children tumbled amid orchids in summer, paddled streams in winter. Electricity not possible, but we didn't want it. Electricity would have forced us out of the glass house. We're still here in the glass and mud, the unbalanced checkbooks, the poems in silence. We hear water, breath, the house letting in light. And this last one is called What Kept Us Going. And this is sort of from a kind of joke that started where the first couple years, the kids always say that we only lived on rice and they had to beg for soy sauce. And they always say that, you know, they would say, can we just have thoy thoth? Because they both had a lisp. What kept us going? It was rice. The children ate rice for breakfast, lunch, dinner. Fireworks, magic, light in the sky, births, weddings, Chinese invention, year of the dragon, of the rabbit. River afloat with candles, children pushing bangs from their eyes, kissing their mothers goodnight under the sky full of stars and falling light. Goodnight, the mothers whispered, waiting for their husbands to come to them, waiting for fireworks between the legs, but rice kept the household going. I'm asking you for fireworks, you give me rice. You say a person can live on rice. You list the uses of black gunpowder. You say the ingredients of fireworks can diverge. I say no divergence is necessary. Fireworks here and now. I'm lifting my dress. Rice is for children. I'm a grown woman now. I need fireworks to survive. It is the Chinese New Year. We celebrate what kept us going. Light in the sky. Light in the water. Fireworks. So, it is my great pleasure to introduce Peggy Shoemaker. She's a wonderful writer, and she's from Alaska. But Peggy was also my very, very first poetry teacher. So a few of my students came here tonight, and so I'll tell you that when I was a kid and I didn't know what I wanted to do, I came into a first English class and a writing class, and Peggy read a poem in class, and it was a poem by Caroline Fourche. And I was very excited and thought, I want to do this, because it was a poem by a woman and the woman was still alive. Because I thought that poetry was mostly written by men who are dead. But the poem was by a woman, and she was still alive. I thought maybe I could do this too. So I completely lost touch of Peggy after I graduated, the way kids do. I wandered off to California to go to graduate school. And then many years later, when I had started the press, I knew she had moved to Alaska and started teaching there, and so I wrote to her and said, if you ever had a book that you were looking for home for, I would be so honored if you would send it to my press. It's not a really big press yet, but it's going to be very important. And I think I sent you some of the books we were doing so you could see that they were very well designed and so on, because that's a very important thing in a press, I thought. I thought Peggy would too. And I knew that by that time she did have a number of books out in the world. So Peggy has had three books out with Red Hen, Underground Rivers, a book called Blaze with a wonderful Alaskan painter, and she's going to show you some of those. A new book, she has a new book that came out with the University of Nebraska Press, which is a nonfiction book, which hopefully she's going to tell you about as well. So she taught in Alaska for many years, and now she speaks all over the country. She's also the editor of an imprint that we have that's called Boreal that publishes an Alaskan writer every year. So Peggy is also a person that wears many different hats and does many different things in the literary world, and is also an amazing writer. Please welcome Peggy Shoemaker.
It's right there.
There you go.
Welcome, everybody, and I can't see any of you because of the way the lights are, but thank you for being here. I really appreciate all of your coming. I'm going to read first from a book called Double Moon, and we tried to get the cover image up, and it's the only image that wouldn't come up in the whole series. I am midwife to this book. As Kate mentioned, I'm bringing out a book a year by an Alaskan writer. In this case, it's an Alaskan visual artist and an Alaskan writer. The visual artist is a woman named Margot Klass, and the writer is a man named Frank Sos. And Margot makes these astonishingly intricate and meticulously beautiful box forms, fills them with found objects, and then Frank responds with small pieces of prose. The one that became the cover, of course, is Double Moon. Double Moon. Here is where we all started from, the bottom of the ocean. Down there, life was dark and cold and lonesome. What else was there for us, ever hopeful, to do but to climb up to the light? Frail creatures, will we always crave more light? Yes, right to the dimming end. Some of these images I'm simply going to show you. You can see that she will juxtapose things like a musical score and a fishing lure and some pieces of pipe. And this one, Frank is convinced, is a portrait of him. It's called Apparently Never. Behind that mustache and silly grin is just a guy. A guy who buys only tools with lifetime guarantees. A guy who will wear a shirt to rags and then use it for rags. When will it light up the tiny bulb of his brain? Love is something that might lend itself to the job at hand, that might wear itself comfortably in, that might grow to be a part of who he is. Yeah. You can see on the sides, too, Margot's focus very often is architectural, and there are little windows on the side. You'll see it in some of the other pieces a little better. And this one also has a skylight, so the light does interesting things with the objects. And by the way, in this book, they have it divided into sections. The first one that I read you comes from the section called Maine, because they spend part of the year in Alaska, part of the year in Maine. The second one was that I just read to you. Let's see, was part of the narrative section. And this one comes from the Japan section. Margot spent a good deal of time in Japan, and the elegance of some of her aesthetic comes from that time in Japan. Let's see. Oh, before I get to the Japanese one, I'll tell you. This one is called I Have Two, and it came because of Margot's experiences with breast cancer. It's a very beautiful piece. She's done a series of pieces that deal with rock, paper, and scissors. And the you can see the combination of the rectangles, the orbs, the triangles. She works a whole lot with the different shapes. And this one. Was inspired by the imperial temple of Shigakuan. Did I say that even close to right? Shigakuan. She was interested in the positive and negative spaces, in the stairwell, in the way that light played. And Then when Frank's imagination got hold of it, it took an entirely different turn. It's called Gateway. In every science fiction movie, there are these priestly characters worshipfully going around in expensive bathrobes, climbing the stately stairs, drawing back the curtain where the mystery is revealed. Distant, lumpy, and scarred. A heavenly body as lonely as our own. Margot also studied medieval art, and a great many of her pieces are either icons or they're focused as altarpieces. And so sometimes they're all closed up, and then they open. Here's another. A different one. This one is from her Alaska section. By the way, if you want to see more, her website is margoklass.com, and you can see a great many more of her pieces. She does the box forms. She also does ceramics and artists' books that are quite incredible. This one's called Indian River Run. This is how the world got made. Made so slowly, so secretly, we scarcely noticed. One drop of water on a rock, then another. Pretty soon a river, then bugs, fish, and the people to catch and eat them. What happens next will not be slow at all, but sudden. We'll only notice when it's gone. Shall I tell you that this piece hangs in my house, and I love to look down in the bottom? There are these stones and then a single die. I just like the chance of it. And then the light coming in from the sides. These, I love the difference in textures in this piece, a piece of very weathered wood that she found. And then the pieces up top are samples that she used to try out different kinds of glaze. But they just, the contrast in the textures is quite amazing. That's probably the biggest fishing lure you're ever going to see. It's about this wide.
How big are most of these boxes?
They vary from about 6 inches by 9 inches up to pieces that are large enough to sit on a shelf, and they might be as much as 2 feet wide. Most of them are fairly small. Whoops. Let me see. That's how it's closed. That's partially open. That's all the way open. And this one's called Learning to Love in a Language We Don't Understand. Quite gorgeous. And then this one. When Frank got a hold of this one, he thought of that huge egg shape as a thought, an idea. Something not at all myself. How big does an idea have to be before it's really big? Gravity, say. How big before it's bigger than we are? Until we become nothing but facts balled up inside it. I dragged a chair over and stood on it. Tried to reach those kinds of ideas. But people told me to think small. That's where the money is. Advertising jingles. Politics. Not God, but God's byproducts. Prayer beads. Prayer cloths. Figurines for the dashboard and yard. Instead, I sat and waited. Lightning. Foxfire, sunrise. So those are the pieces from Double Moon. Thank you. The next image is Blaze. There's a painter in Alaska named Kessler Woodward. He's the preeminent painter in Alaska at this moment. If you go through the new part of the Anchorage Airport and you look up, you're going to see probably, Joe, what do you think it is, 60 feet wide? You're going to see a mosaic of looking up through a birch canopy, and that's Kess's work. He and I worked at the same university. We were both furniture. He was chair of the art department. I was chair of the English department. And we both said, we should do something together, but we had to wait till we both retired because every hour was spoken for twice. Finally, when we did retire, I took poems over to his studio, and he very politely said, I took all the Alaskan poems, and he said, I was really hoping we could work with the sexy poems. So I brought a bunch of other poems over, and a funny thing happened. When he looked at 30 years of my poems, he began to paint. And when I looked at 30 years of his paintings, I began to write, and the book got fatter. So here are a few. This is the cover image. It's called Chase's Woods. By the way, when he's up close, he says he's he's an abstract painter, and when he is up close, half a brush length away, paintings are utterly abstract, and it's only when you back up that they resolve into trees. And he likes that give and take. And he also had a very good attitude. This painting in the book is about 4 inches by 6 inches, and in real life it's about 4 feet by 6 feet, very highly textured. And he said our job in the book was not to get the reproduction to look like the painting, because it never would. It was to get the reproduction to look good. And I think that Red Hand did a beautiful job with that. So this one, let's see. And these poems are mine. Strong stars. Mottled grouse peck up gizzard stones before the first snow. Seasons move on as if the human heart were not infinitely fragile. The sow bear's stained snout lifts, sniffs the wind, then bows to claws raking in stems, berries, rasping leaves. A 12-year-old, please, tells her aunt, I kissed a boy 4 times and my tooth grew back in. Beside the barrow ditch, the bandy-legged fox bounds into finger-thin willow. Stars surround the green wash of the aurora, God's love, the moisture of a woman's orgasm. From here, we can see much farther than we can walk. We walk to the edges of our bodies. Many of his paintings live at the Anchorage Museum of History and Art and the University of Alaska Museum of the North, if you'd like to see more. He also has both a website and a blog spot. By the way, people say, you paint a lot of winter scenes, and anyone from Alaska would know this is a spring scene because there's enough light to make shadows. It was in the teens today. This one's called Rime, the R-I-M-E kind, the frosty kind. Overnight, each twig has grown white fur. The air so still, snow throws into sharp relief. Each branch plus each branch's crooked, light-bent sense of self, crystallized. Last night, your voice roused my limbs, warm under flannel. Licked each branch, split and hollow, licked into flame the untamed liquids, flammable, spilled down your chin, moisture from the heartwood, risen unseasonably, springing free not just from me, nor your snow cloud juices, just from you. No. These waters rise from hot springs at the center of the sacred, from the little stone overlooked often, plain little stone where vibrations from each life ever lived, each life yet to be, gather. Kes says that every time he paints a birch tree, he thinks, this is the last one. And then he goes in the woods, and they're just so incredibly beautiful and so individual that he comes back and paints. This is a cabin above the Arctic Circle in Gates of the Arctic National Park that Joe and I like to frequent. This is how we get there, in a 1943 Grumman Widgeon. Maybe I'll leave that one on while I read Walker Lake. There's no road to this. And what, the nearest airstrips may be, what, Joe? 60 miles, 90 miles? 40 miles, over at Beddoes. It's called Walker Lake. The sow bear ripped down the boat tarp, scraped black fur into twisted wing nuts. That bear eased her itch and disappeared. And still she stayed near while we hiked uphill to fill our jug, the spring covered over with autumn's leavings. We skimmed clear frosted growth floating, sank our jerry cans, felt them pull deeper. The surface healed around wrists, stiff with cold. Bubbles shook free from river weeds, rose up, tumbled downstream. The still place returned reflection. Birch startled us with gold so loud, our bodies flared like fireweed gone to seed. Twilight put its slant on the afternoon. Four loons swam near our seaplane, nudging this strange relative who would not speak. The moon had eaten itself down to the rind, and in that sliver, that lingering of autumn, stars borrowed the voices of loons. One more image of the lake. Oh, and that's Joe and I with the farthest north bottle of Lisano sauce. Another of Kess's, he saw this as a very peaceful image, and it was put next to an article in Harper's Magazine. It was put next to an article that had to do with the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas. Go figure. These four live in an entirely white chapel, except for these four paintings. They're about 7 feet tall. Give you an idea of scale. And he calls them seasons of praise. And I'll just read you spring. You all know Botticelli's very famous painting Primavera. Yeah, with the women in their little costumes that are all floaty. Let's see. That has to do with spring in Alaska, absolutely zip. Usually the spring, we count spring when the ice goes off the river. That's usually in May. Spring. Botticelli never pictured breakup boots, black ice, red pickup hauled back up the bank after falling through. A few days sun. All in one day, the leaves. Open, open and open. Marbled gold, pollen floats. Every year since it was a river, this. Upstream, an ice dam groans, screams, scrapes, gives. Whole new breakup, huge flows blunder downriver, gouge up whole trees. Gossamer river, crushed ice shushes, slushes, 3 days floating by. So that's summer, autumn, which takes about 20 minutes, and winter that takes about 8 months, although that's really spring. And finally, this one is a little bit taller than I am, and that also lives in the Anchorage Museum of History and Art, so you can go visit it if you want to. I'm going to end my reading with the title poem. Kate had mentioned that I have a new book from Red Hen, and it looks like this. And the poem I'd like to read to you is called Gnawed Bones. If language is bones, hard parts of speech, what do skulls of pack rats crushed into owl pellets have to tell us? If this delicate pelvis once balanced a gravid javelina, what word passes on to her shotes? If cicada shells hang on like single mothers starved for touch, what does hot wind whisper through them? If every day reenacts creation, if we live here, now, in the first world and the last, let us speak in our bones languages of water from all skies, from deep underground. Let our bones quench the thirst of history, thirst for all we yearn to sip, marrow of each dry tongue. Thank you so much for coming out tonight.
So Joe and Peggy, of course, live in Alaska and have come here to read. But Doug Kearney's wife just had twins. So I think we should all give him an applause for coming anyway. Because that's got to have been a busy little time for you, Doug. So when you come up, you got to tell us their names and everything. Because we need that information, right, everybody? I think we do. Doug's first book was with Red Hen Press, and it was called Fearsome, and Doug read all over. He read for us at the Geffen with Saul Williams, completely packed the place. People were, there were a few people there for Saul, but it was an absolutely wonderful, wonderful performance, and Doug just, has been read all over the country with that book. It was his first book. And then he went on to win the Whiting Award. And his second book, which is here, The Black Automaton, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, is with Fence Books. And Doug actually designs his own book covers in his spare time when he's not writing poetry, getting ready to have twins, and doing his other job, which is teaching at CalArts. Like me, Doug also writes librettos to operas. I don't know where he is with that right now, but I'm sure he's got one in the works. Doug is an extremely talented individual, and I know in the next 5 years he's just going to be absolutely huge. So you are going to be very, very glad that you heard him here tonight. Please welcome Doug Kearney.
Hey, everybody. Whoa. Hey. My twins' names are Elijah Samir Kearney and Kalila Elise Kearney, and they're actually in the NICU at Good Samaritan right now. Radio. The first black you met was on the radio. This is true, even if you lived with blacks. The first black to speak the word radio knew it meant the same as blood. The first black to know blood meant radio claimed radio meant love to better lure you. The first black you dreamed about was on the radio and waited for you there each night to fuck you. You still believe this and sleep with the radio on or off. It all depends. The first blacks to realize they were blacks became radios at once, singing something that could never be English. The first black to confess it was a radio did so to account for the snow filling its voice. The first black you heard was a radio and did not speak English. Even if it did, radios cannot speak. The first blacks to change radio's meaning from love back to blood are still here and want to fuck you. They are doing so on the radio right now. You don't like it, but go to sleep. I'm going to be reading poems from a number of different sources from the two books, as well as some poems that are in journals and things. This next poem is called The Post, and it has to kind of go with The Post because there's a hyphen at the end and nothing to continue. But it's written sort of in response to when Obama was elected, people love to say, we're in a post-race America, which is so ridiculous. So this is a poem in a dedication to that. It's called The Post, and there is a brief appearance by the Coppertone girl in it. She needs to get her royalties, so I'll make sure she knows that she's being acknowledged. The Post pulled free my skin at its linchpin for to be post, and now I am pink meat sitting at the desktop, typing things to do with my obsolete rap. Parachute from scarlet places in furs. Bundle it for laundering with jodhpurs and tuxedo. Double Dutch with Harlemites on MLK. Trade it in for coupons at Marina Side Auctions. Have you seen my lustrous skin? I mistook what she stroked for Saran. Her handbag Yorkie pulled it down, shucked her hips like stripped bikinis. She didn't seem to notice her shiny pink beneath, just as new as old presidents. How will I get into the jams? My mirror's full of meat. Someone tell me when to dance. Selector, the wind takes my discarded skin, walks it tipsy down the street. A black and white trawls the curb and flashes lights, then remembers when we are and pulls off. My skin is quite the gentleman, lingering by the shop glass, coolly hungerless. America's different now, isn't it? The circling birds are tracing hugs. Yes, they want us all inside. There, a pink child flies my skin. A kite. Look, Mommy, he said, and she did. See how high it can go, she said. America is so different now, yes? How many pronouns can fit in one skin? The pronoun for U.S. citizens, us or them. Skinless now, as I've become, how the air apprehends the meat under. Gone so far, cleaving our skins to ticker tape. The winners? A parade for them next. From us, or the other way round. But save the litter when it's done. Once marching ends, we'll toss it again. I'm going to do some perms from Fearsome, first book. Kate Gale was so kind to put this out. And I don't know how many people here are writers or no writers, but when somebody is foolish enough to take your first book, it's an incredible experience. And I'm eternally grateful to Kate Gale and Red Hen for giving me the opportunity to open up a box full of books with my name on it. And thank you. And it's important, and not just my book, but it's important that you buy the books that small presses put out. They don't make a lot of money, and the Rice poem was sweet and funny, but it's probably truer than you'd like to think. So really support the small presses out there. You know, go to bookstores, go to Amazon, but also go to their websites too, and you'll find some wonderful stuff. This is a poem called At the Pink Teacup. It's from my first book. And I think all you need to know are two things, really. The Pink Teacup is the name of a soul food restaurant in Greenwich Village. The other thing that you need to know is on the way to the Pink Teacup, depending upon how you go, there's a basketball court called the Cage. And the reason why it's called the Cage is it's surrounded by a chain link fence. And people will come at all times of day, locals and tourists, to watch the people play street ball. At the Pink Teacup, for my friend Kiata. Kiata cuts sweet tea with talk, the room empty but for us, the brother waiting, and love songs. Later, he'll recall tanks from a stoop, carve a sonnet of the day no one was underground in New York, as if the sky needed holding up and everyone came out to help. He'll pay for our food and we'll stare from the stoops as attachés commute past the swollen garbage bags flowering in dusk. But now he's talking about love. His tongue a knife he cools in free refills the menu says we shouldn't get. He's talking about what he wants, how he wishes it wouldn't burn his grandfather down, or that brothers would remember how fickle the Bible is. And the brother at the Pink Teacup is refilling our glasses. He smiles like it's the easiest thing in the world, and the menu looks stupid and petty. Later, Kiata will talk about gas masks and fruit stands, how all he could do was cuss the man who looked like some glass-eyed insect buying apples. You're scaring the kids, you fucking asshole! And how scared he was of what happens when everyone looks to the sky for messages and keeps everything sweet somewhere cold. New York will offer us bouquets in black plastic. The menus will fold. Commuters will buy apples and forget their gas masks in the closet. Right now, Kiata isn't talking about love. The knife is in his hand, cutting salmon croquettes. He doesn't want to burn his people down. But later, he'll talk about Sikh women beaten in Harlem, the bumper stickers and flags flying past us as we watch brothers hoop in a cage. Before then, he'll talk about what brothers do once they find out. He is full of sweet tea and pink flesh. The brothers, full of sweat, argue over fouls. The cage fence, full of spectators like flies on the black garbage bags. The fruit stands, full of apples, some bruised as the Sikh women. And New York, full of bumper stickers, crawls back underground. Scrambles for its love songs, Bibles, tanks, gas masks. Kiata wishes people would remember how fickle the flag is. And right now he is talking about love. When the brother comes back with the pitcher, Kiata is through. Later, he will love the brothers. He pays now. Thank you all very much. And thank you to the library and to Aloud for bringing me here. I love that word, Aloud, because, you know, it's allowed, but also allowed is in permission. That just is great. So when I was a kid growing up in libraries, I didn't literally grow up in libraries, but I go to them when I was growing up. I learned that, you know, you had a library voice that you kept rather quiet. But the title of this series seems to allow me to use an outside voice inside. So this next poem that I'm going to read from the first book is called Live Evil. And Live Evil is the name of a Miles Davis album. I wrote this poem because it's built into the epigraphs why the poem is here. But when people talk about Miles Davis, they oftentimes talk about what a brilliant musician he was. But something that people don't like to talk about as much is his history of abuse of women in his life. Most pertinently, this poem is Cicely Tyson, his wife, who he physically abused. I read an essay by Pearl Clegg called Mad at Miles. The essay includes an instruction that's a quote at the beginning of this poem. Then there's a quote from a Terrence Hayes poem, which I don't think is a response to the essay. And then there's a quote from a friend of mine when I told him that I'd followed the essay's rules. You can put lots of quotes in poems. They're free. So three quotes, Live Evil. Quote, Miles was guilty of self-confessed violent crimes against women such that we ought to break his records, burn his tapes, and scratch up his CDs until he acknowledges and apologizes. Pearl Clegg. Quote, "The trumpet's mouth is apology." Terrence Hayes. Quote, "You just write a poem about your need to do that." Ahmad Jamal Johnson. Live Evil. The pin's point comes down on the butterfly. The knuckle comes down on Miss Sicily. The mallet comes down on the CD case. Wait! The mallet comes down on the butterfly. The pin's point comes down on Miss Sicily. The knuckle comes down on the CD case. Ah! The knuckle comes down on the butterfly. The mallet comes down on Miss Sicily. The pin's point comes down on the CD case. Bit! The pin's point, the knuckle, the mallet, damn it! The butterfly, Miss Sicily, the CD case. The rose's velvet plumes rip at the aphid's spit, but that feeds something. The phoenix's dazzling petals in the ash dross, but that births something. The martyr's ecstatic smile as the bowels give, but that saves something. What did we make? Listen to the butterfly. The pinpoint makes no sound, sticking the felt shell, no brass wail into the air. Here, it's silent as a necktie. This isn't quite right. Miss Sicily, a CD case, and the pinstripe three-piece? Did he wear a pinstripe three-piece? Did she kiss its lapel with red lipstick? Did he stick her lips red? Did she kiss it? I threw out the liner notes. I don't know. Sometimes he wore a pinstripe three-piece and a dazzling tie. The air was what bowels give. I have a mallet. Did he kiss her? Lips red. Did he stick her? With a pin's point. Listen to the brass wail. Listen to the butterfly. The plastic breaks and the silent breaks. This is the song of a man thinking he can build a rose with a mallet, make an infant phoenix with a pin's point, be a martyr with knuckles. This is the song of a man who threw out the liner notes. He wore ash dross. Wait a bit! Damn it! Miss Sicily, why won't you wait? Listen to the song of a man giving what bowels give. He had a mallet, and the oils in the hands cripple. The butterfly won't fly again, so butter wait, butter stay, butter still. My fists are felt shit. What have we made? Better wait. Stay still. Listen to the song of a man in its three-piece shell. It comes down. It comes down. The pin's point. The knuckle. The mallet. Wait a bit. No birthing. No saving. No feeding. Damn it! Listen to the song of a man who breaks. What have we made?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. I have time enough to do one more. I'm going to leave the choice up to you. A poem about deserts in Los Angeles, or a peppy poem about the Middle Passage? Middle Passage. Peppy poem about the Middle Passage or deserts in Los Angeles? Okay, that sounded like mostly a Middle Passage. So this is from the new book, The Black Automaton. And okay, so the Middle Passage. For those of y'all who don't know or think you know, but when somebody says a peppy poem about it, you think I must be thinking of something different. The Middle Passage is the name of the route that ships use to transport Africans from the old world to the new, which is great because they have Adidas here, and we didn't have that in Africa. So This poem here, there's a couple things I'd like to say about it before I begin. One, how many people here, and this is actual real audience participation, so how many people here have ever either fed pigeons in a park or seen it done on television? Excellent. Okay, so a few of you. Animals are intelligent when it comes to getting food. And according to the Discovery Channel, sharks are the world's perfect predators. So they were no exception. If animals can get food without having to really fight for it or search for it, they're going to go there. They're going to flock there. Sharks, because of this principle, would follow ships that were along the Middle Passage. The reason why is because there was human waste that would fall from that in the way that we tend to think of human waste in terms of offal and food scraps. But there were also humans being thrown into that water as well. Because, you see, when you have a bunch of people stacked up like IKEA bookshelves and one of them gets sick, well, that virus can pass along the entire inventory and kill them. And since dead Africans weren't really useful until the invention of gangster rap, at that time, you really wanted to prevent that kind of thing from happening. So if someone got sick, you would throw them overboard so that the sharks could then eat them and you'd protect the rest of your investment. I'm not going to go into huge details about this, but just know that this tactic was also used to keep crews, the members of the crew, in line, and that sometimes when people would run out of food on these ships because they were just poor planners, they would fish using Africans, sometimes alive, sometimes dead, using a method known as trawling, and it's how you catch usually larger fish. You're in a moving vehicle, and you trail the bait behind you, and so they would catch sharks using this method, kill the sharks, and they could eat them. So there you go. So there's some sharks in this poem. Also in this poem are quotations from a few different sources, and I'm going to name them so I don't get in trouble. The first is Parliament, and that's the funk group, not the governing body. The next is The Little Mermaid by Disney's version of The Little Mermaid. Then there's a little bit of T.S. Eliot, and then there's some Robert Hayden. I think we're good. Oh, a duppy? There's a duppy. Duppy. Duppies are the ghosts of wrongfully murdered people. They are typical of Haiti. And this peppy poem is called Swim Chant for Nigger Merfolk, an aqua boogie set in lapis. Never learn to swim, but me show can dive. Over million ship, do wah wah ooh. Over million ship. Wow, wow. Let your fish bones slip on in. 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 Make a wish, ye blackfish. Make o feed, be black bleed. They's company coming, coming. Hammerheads hammers head to ham or head till hammer's fed. Oh, they's company knocking, knocking. Great white jaw. Ah, great white jaw jaw juju. Not, not. No, no. They's company. Dining, dining. Duppy guppy say, stay we in azure amber. Can't remember, can't remember. Oh, they's company, haintin', haintin'. And all about was a darkening cloud and the gullets filled of brine and kine. Cattle, chattel, charnel channel of a deep blue. See all about that darkening cloud and the gullets filled of water and the gullets filled of slaughter. Assault, assault. Charnel channel of a deep blue sea. Poseidon slides his foaming shroud, assured no one will see. Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you, what more is you looking for? So sang a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the flow of silent seas. Oh, ye nigger merfolk, a love song for song lovers. It'll all be fin, fine. Fin, fine. Attention, nigger mermaids, mermen and merninnies. Chain like hooked and sink sardinies. Do not bleed in the sea. The stains won't wash out. We ain'tn't responsible for your mess. Much obliged, the management voyage through. They's company, haintin', haintin'. Can't remember, can't remember. Oh, they's company, haintin', haintin'. The stains won't wash out. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.